Welcome to the Negro Leagues, our Major Leagues podcast, a production of Sports Reference. I'm your host, Curtis Harris, and today we are beginning a special three-part run of shows discussing the rise, the maintenance, and the fall of the color line and Major League Baseball. Later in this run of shows, Todd Peterson will help us discuss how the AL, the NL, and the various Negro Leagues operated during this era of segregation. And then Michael Lomax will help us learn about the fallout and the implications of the end of segregation in baseball. However, today we're joined by Ryan Swanson, and he'll tell us and help us learn more about how the color line was established in the first place shortly after the Civil War and during the era of Reconstruction. Dr. Swanson is an associate professor at the University of New Mexico, and his latest book was published in 2019 and is called The Strenuous Life, focusing on Theodore Roosevelt and the making of the American athlete. But I think his first book is really where we're going to get our expertise on this matter. It's called When Baseball Went White: Reconstruction, Reconciliation, and Dreams of a National Pastime. That book won the 2015 Society for American Baseball Research Award, and it is an excellent book if you're willing and wanting to learn more about the history of how baseball began segregation in the majors. But here is my conversation with Ryan Swanson. It's a great one. As a Civil War buff, I definitely had too much fun with this one, but I hope y'all enjoy it. Here we go. So we are joined by Ryan Swanson, Professor Ryan Swanson, I should say, who's going to help us learn about the establishment of baseball's color line. But before we get into the nitty gritty details of all that, could you tell us, Ryan, a little bit more about who you are, what you do, and how you got into baseball and sports history?
Sure. Yeah, it's great to be with you, Curtis. Great project. Excited to talk with you today. So, again, my name is Ryan Swanson. I currently am an associate professor at the University of New Mexico. I teach in the Honors College at UNM, mostly sports history. And so that's kind of my area of interest and expertise, if you will. I also am fortunate. I work with student athletes at the University of New Mexico. So our Lobos program, called the Lobos Scholars Program. So I work with high achieving student athletes, of which there are many at the Division I level. At UNM, for example, you know, above a 3.0 average for student athletes. So that's my job now. You asked kind of how I got interested in the history of baseball and sport and race.
Yep.
So I think it's kind of a typical story, perhaps. I was big into sports as a kid. I played everything they would let me play, you know, soccer, basketball. I ran track. I just loved to play as a kid. So I played, you know, all the way through high school. I ran track and cross country in college. Really wish I could have played basketball, but didn't have the skills at the college level. So I just love sports, you know, kind of personally. And then I will say also, I think contributing to that was the fact that I read a ton of biographies as a kid. And so that was where I went. You know, I'm old enough that you had to actually go to the library, and, you know, I would always go, you know, back to the biography section. And so I read all the biographies of athletes I could get my hands on. I don't know. You think about those biographies, you know, a pitcher will have, for example, like a great season, like Oral Hershiser, for example, and they come out with a biography like 6 months later. They're usually not the highest quality in terms of their literary output, but I was the kid who was like right on it reading those biographies, you know? So I just really love sports. I love the stories. And so I went through college, started out as pre-med, basically failed calculus and chemistry right out of the box as a freshman. thought I better make some changes here. I just loved history. I loved my history classes. So basically finally ended up as a history major, dabbled with some other things along the way, but went on to grad school, as many historians do. When I was working on my PhD at Georgetown, I was really interested in the Reconstruction era. Believe it or not, I wrote my master's thesis on Andrew Johnson. You don't really want to become a Johnson scholar. I don't think that there's much.
Yeah, no, that's
Interesting topics, but yeah.
that was not what I wanted my life's work to be. So when I moved into the dissertation stage of things, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I wanted to write about the politics of Reconstruction, such a fascinating time and such a huge missed opportunity, I felt like, for the United States. You know, post-Civil War, there was an opportunity for a significant restart politically that, very long story short, didn't happen. And so I was interested in the Reconstruction era. And so kind of aimlessly in my dissertation process, I just started gathering newspaper articles about politicians. And so I was doing the microfilm thing, which I don't know if you had to do much of this, pretty much gone by now.
I have gone through a tiny bit of microfilm, but fortunately, I have not had a deep dives into that.
Well, count yourself lucky. It was the way it was, 20 years ago when I was doing this or so. But as I was going through just all these newspapers randomly, really kind of looking for stories, especially in D.C., I was really interested in the Mid-Atlantic area. I was at Georgetown and thought there was a nice mix there of kind of North and South culturally and politically, a strong racial mix. And so, as I was looking for these political stories, I started coming across box scores. And in the 1860s and 70s, the box score was still kind of in its infancy, but it was in newspapers. And I kept coming across these box scores that were just incredible. They'd be, 143-27, And as I'm a baseball fan, most box scores are like 42, right? But basically the rules were in flux at this point. So baseball had these incredible scores. And so I just started gathering up box scores while I was working on my dissertation. And I told my advisor at the time, Michael Kazin, who's a huge baseball fan, that I was kind of doing this on the side. And I have to credit him. He finally just said, "This is a project. Why don't you do baseball during Reconstruction as your way to understand the politics?" And so I feel like he just opened up like a door for me and said, "Just do what you want to do. You're interested in sports. That's real history." And so that's kind of how I got into studying sports and history. And since then, I've moved up chronologically a little bit. My last book was on Teddy Roosevelt and the rise of American sports. But I think sports is a great avenue by which to understand the United States. A lot of records, a lot of coverage, a lot of documents. And so that's kind of how I got to where I am now.
Just for the listeners, me and Ryan were talking beforehand, and I told him that I am a huge Civil War and Reconstruction historian as well. So very excited to have someone on who can discuss the importance of that era, but specifically as it relates to baseball. Because is it your first book you wrote when baseball went white?
That's correct. Yeah. So it was my dissertation, which eventually turned into a book. Yeah.
Yep. So So I've read the book. It's really excellent. And could you tell us this would take a while, but I guess get us started on explaining how did the consequences and just the consequences and results of the Civil War help start the push toward a color line in baseball?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, as you say, it's a big topic. I think many Americans, many historians consider the Civil War, among the formative events in U.S. history. And so you've got that period from 1861 to 1865, where the entire nation is brought into this deadly conflict. 700,000 men die on the battlefield. In some places in the American South, there are injuries and deaths in every family, really. The enrollment rate was so high in the South, especially. And I've always found the American Civil War interesting. I wouldn't call myself a military historian. I don't know the ins and outs of this campaign versus that one, although that stuff is certainly important. But when the war's over, in my mind, to really simplify things, kind of two things are decided after all that bloodshed. The Union will stay together and slavery will not be part of the United States moving forward. And those are two big things, right? I mean, that's a big step in the right direction, but it leaves all sorts of unanswered questions. And putting the pieces back together is really the big question. How do you, what do you do now that the nation is kind of the fighting is over? And there's some really interesting scholarship out there on, kind of what's done after the war is over. And I think it's really kind of interesting to think about how the politicians tried to, kind of rectify this new reality they had. There was on one end of the spectrum, there were people who basically said, secession was not legitimate ever. Therefore, these states were never technically out of the United States. Therefore, yep, we just pick up and keep going, right? that in my mind, all these years later seems a little bit illegitimate to, you know, say like, let's just pick up where we were. And so if that's kind of on one end of the spectrum, they're on maybe the other end of the spectrum, there's gotta be different ends of different spectrums here, but you know, then there are the politicians who say that, secession fundamentally broke the contract that was in place in the United States. Therefore, the states that left and have been defeated are basically conquered territories. And the U.S. Congress can do as they please with these states moving forward.
Yeah, that'd be the Thaddeus Stevens.
There you go. Yeah. And all of this is, as you know, Curtis, is cased in racial politics. So what comes next? Are we going to let the South go back to being essentially some version of a slaveocracy, or are we really going to move forward with some radical changes as Stevens and others would do? So, what does this have to do with baseball? The Civil War political conversations, post-Civil War political conversations envelop everything in the United States. So in some ways there is not a separation, but when the war is over, men come home and they have to pick up the pieces. And a lot of changes are made in American culture following the war. And, one of them is the fact that Americans at that time, men especially, are very communal. They form all sorts of organization. And, one person said it after the war, Americans are wonderfully gregarious. So they join organizations, they join churches, they establish clubs and charter groups and all kinds of different things. And, I think I don't like to oversimplify it and say, well, these men were part of the army and were soldiers, and therefore they tried to replicate that at home on a baseball team. That doesn't really make sense, but I do think they had been in this formative experience, and the post-war world made these communal organizations really important. And so the Masons, the Odd Fellows, all these groups form. And as part of that club scene, baseball clubs pop up all over the United States. And baseball had been around for a while. I'm not going to get into the when did baseball begin debate. That's a wormhole that can get you stuck. Obviously, it wasn't invented by Abner Doubleday. The game had been around in some form for a long time. But what happens after the Civil War is the game gets much more organized very quickly. And so these baseball clubs pop up by the hundreds, by the thousands, really, during the 1860s and 70s. And they have to fit themselves into kind of the fabric of American society at this time. So let me stop here. I can go on, Curtis, but what do you think?
I guess something I would just know real quick is that black and white soldiers, served in the war, mm-hmm. well, for the Union side of the war. So yeah, the idea, the spirit of, of camaraderie and brotherhood that comes out of it and kind of have mm-hmm. these communal organizations, that was a black and white affair, which I think helps us kind of understand why the color line, was so interesting in the fact that it was mm-hmm. drawn, or mm-hmm. See some parallels. So let's go that direction. So I know, for example, that the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the mm-hmm. veterans group for mm-hmm. Union soldiers, mm-hmm. They would have local posts that mm-hmm. sometimes were segregated into black mm-hmm. and white posts, but other times they were integrated where blacks and mm-hmm. whites would be in the same posts. Mm-hmm. So I know that's one example that I know of, but when it pertained to baseball, how did they work out the baseball clubs? They just, it's not maybe the right word, but did they organically start as like separately black and white? Were there integrated clubs mm-hmm. or was it a deliberate process to make them integrated to make them segregated when they had prior been integrated?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, as as a historian, Curtis, and as you know, when we stop and kind of look at it, the fact that slavery ended did not do away with racism. It did not do away with bias. And so after the war is over, and as you point out, African-American soldiers served in large numbers. And so when they came home as well, they joined into this kind of communal club joining, frenzy that was happening. And for the most part, the clubs that were formed right after the Civil War were segregated by race. But as you say, initially, during the first decade especially, that is by some measure choice. Now, racism pervades, and so there's all kinds of factors going on. But what you don't have is any rules or statutes made by baseball leadership that is separating those teams In terms of that kind of segregation at this time. So in Washington, D.C., for example, Black Americans, Black men join baseball clubs in large numbers. And so I point out in my book, and actually for the piece I wrote for Baseball Reference, that Charles Douglas, the son of Charles Douglas, is one of these Black men who joins a baseball club right after the Civil War. And his clubs, he's part of the Washington Mutual and the Washington Alert baseball clubs. I think they're pretty typical of what happens in the 1860s and 70s. You've got a group of relatively well-off Black men, many of whom are employed by the federal government in D.C. And, they are, too, looking for connection and community and recreation. And baseball clubs become part of that answer. And so these clubs are primarily separated by race in the initial period. But the race line isn't drawn very strictly. And so there is some intermingling back and forth. There's sharing of baseball fields initially in the 1860s. There's sharing of equipment sometimes. It's not uncommon for a Black team to invite, a white ball player from across town to come umpire a game. So there's an intermingling and intermixing. But I think it's important to point out what you don't see after the American Civil War is a real clamoring by Black ball players to join white clubs. There's a very understandable sense that these Black organizations that are being formed are valuable and vibrant, and they are their own thing. And so they're very important organizations in society. And so that's kind of where we're at in the years immediately following the Civil War. You've got hundreds of baseball clubs forming, Black and white. They're primarily along the eastern seaboard of the United States, but also in, emerging places like Chicago and St. Louis, Atlanta. And they are divided by race, but not officially during the first decade of the game. And so from there, we'll see the race line start to form.
Yeah, no, that's actually a good point you made there about, a desire for Black Americans just coming out of slavery to kind of have institutions of their own. So it's not necessarily that they would want to be segregated into Black clubs, mm-hmm. but they would just like to have a club of their own. And that just kind of mm-hmm. happened to be all Black clubs at that moment in time. Going forward, I guess it's now getting into the 1870s. And also you mentioned how, it wasn't dictated from on high that these teams had to be all white or all Black. Mm-hmm. So what gets what gets baseball authorities, white baseball authorities, into this idea and into this mood that we have to explicitly exclude Black people from these white organizations?
So there's an organization, the National Association of Baseball Players, which is formed just before the beginning of the Civil War. And basically what this organization is doing is trying to make sure that baseball is played the same way throughout the United States. If you look in the 1850s, just quickly to go backwards, the mm-hmm. rules are still very much in dispute. What are the pitching rules? You have to deliver it underhand. For a long time, there's a belief that the pitcher needs to fairly deliver the ball to the batter so that they have a chance to hit it. Or are you allowed, is there some deception involved? Can you pitch it overhand with a curve? These kinds of things. And so the National Association of Baseball Players forms in part just to iron out the rules, to codify the game, to make sure it's a respectable game. And so that organization lives through the Civil War. And then as Reconstruction is ongoing, the National Association of Baseball Players is the organizational body of baseball at this time. And for the first couple of years following the war, they don't have really anything to say about politics or racial politics other than to say baseball itself is completely apolitical. And so they really want to point this out. Oh, baseball, it's above politics. It's above race. It a little bit harkens to some of these, things that people, throw out very unjustly now. They kind of just dribble. Sports are supposed to be above politics. Of course, I don't believe that's true at all. But that there's a similar kind of idea following the Civil War that maybe baseball can just be baseball and somehow be separate from this huge war we just had and the fact that the entire society is undergoing this revolution. Long story short, that doesn't work. And so in 1867, things start to get real in terms of really kind of laying down this segregation line in baseball. There were state associations under the National Association of Baseball Players, and they're the ones who kind of feed into the National Association. So in 1867, a Black ball club in Pennsylvania, the Pythians, one of the most famous ball clubs of this era, sent a delegate to the Pennsylvania Association of Baseball Players asking for official membership. And this is bureaucracy 101. Like, these organizations have presidents, vice presidents, they have votes, they have motions. It's very kind of stilted. But the Pythians were an extremely successful team in Philadelphia. They were led by a gentleman named Octavius Cato, who was a trailblazer in terms of education, political rights, and a ball player. And so the Pythians actually had pretty much an undefeated season in 1867. And so in October of that year, they send their delegate and say, we want official recognition under the Pennsylvania Association, which then would give us official standing kind of nationally in the National Association of Baseball Players. And what happens to the delegate at that meeting, his name is Raymond Burr, is he is greeted with kind words by all his white colleagues. Glad to have you here. Great season, pats on the back, you know, all around. But when it gets, the rubber hits the road, and he looks for support for his application for membership for his club, basically all these, you know, these well-wishers kind of shrink away. And they're not willing to go on record and support the Pythians' desire to be accepted as full members of the Pennsylvania Association. And so, you know, in terms of how segregation works, I think this is an interesting case study, because what you don't have is kind of a caricature of racism. You don't have these people shouting racial epithets, or you don't have, no, it's all kind of gentlemanly and kind, and it's very, a lot of decorum involved, but they simply won't back his measure. And so they basically force him to withdraw his petition for membership. And he only does that because he reads the room and recognizes that, you know, it's going to be rejected outright if he doesn't. And so this is really how baseball becomes, you know, takes the first step towards official segregation. Because here now you have the Pennsylvania Association saying, we will not accept an application from a black club for membership. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, bore your listeners too much, but basically a couple months later, they have a meeting of the National Association of Baseball Players. And the same thing happens at the national level. The nominating committee there at the National Association says, we expect, you know, to kind of paraphrase the quote, we expect that none of the applications come from colored clubs, quote unquote. And so there you have another kind of precedent put on the books. And so by the end of 1867, only 2 years after the war is over, you have something on the books saying that white and black ball clubs can't exist wholly within the same organization.
Yeah. Before we get further along, and I guess discuss the more hard and official codification of the color line. You know, which, you know, clearly that's what the case is by 1900, where you know, blacks are not allowed whatsoever in any case in Major League Baseball. I do want to get your thoughts on whether what was happening in baseball was somewhat of a, whether it was a reflection or even maybe presaging what would happen across wider American society, because. Like you mentioned, Reconstruction was in a lot of ways a missed opportunity, but black men did get the right to vote during the 1860s after the war. There were elected officials, black elected officials to Congress and in state governments across the country. You know, by the 1880s and especially 1890s, you see the black officials being removed from office, black people beginning to lose the vote. So what it sounds like to me is that what was happening in baseball kind of, again, don't want to, maybe presage is too strong a word, but it definitely hints at what's about to happen to black people in the country.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I think that the idea that sports serve as, you know, a cause for change and brings out the better angels of our being is mostly myth when you look back in American history. Sports usually serves as a mirror to society. The biases and hatred that we see in broader society come out in sports. But I think you can make the case in baseball following the Civil War that actually the game's a little bit ahead on the segregation and racism front. Because as you say, you know, in states like South Carolina, they're, you know, you're electing black senators. And for a time, there is optimism that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are going to bring real change. And they do create real change. The ballot becomes much more accessible. Elected officials are happening from the African-American community. Meanwhile, baseball, it only takes a couple of years here for it to begin putting things on the books in terms of segregation. So I think I would agree with what you're saying here. And it's just one other thing in terms of baseball. In the game of baseball, it's all done under the banner of wanting to create a national pastime. And that's geographically speaking, you know, so how are we going to bring in southern states? How are we going to bring in St. Louis, Atlanta in terms of cities? Well, the only way they're going to play, and this is the white leadership talking, is if we make the game kind of culturally palatable, i.e. if we make the game racially restrictive. And so to say it's ironic that the goal of having a national pastime requires the separation of the races, you know, is too soft. But that's really what's happening. It's under this banner of we're gonna have a national pastime that the better ideals of Reconstruction really lose out.
Yeah, and actually, I'm very glad you brought that up. So I actually thought that was very interesting. A very interesting point you made in your book was about that. I don't know. I just wanted, do you have any more thoughts on that? Just, how this drive for a national pastime, you know, in those folks' minds, meant that you had to get rid of Black people as participants.
Yeah. So if you take Henry Chadwick, for example, he's the self-proclaimed father of baseball. Anytime you give yourself a nickname, you're suspect in my book. But nevertheless, he calls himself the father of baseball. You know, and he's a newspaper publisher and writer, and he pamphleteer of baseball, really. And so he is kind of baseball's leading crusader in the 1850s, 60s, 70s. And I mean, what he's really wanting for baseball is that it's respectable and it's seen as legit, that it's not a kid's game. It's a man's game. And so it has coherent rules. It is suitably manly and kind of rough, which, you know, baseball is not particularly physical, but, you know, it. And so he's really concerned about creating kind of this image for baseball and that it's organized and that when leagues form, for example, that, you know, that team that's in last place finishes its schedule despite the fact it can't win the championship. So he's very much trying to organize the game in that manner. And in doing so, Chadwick and many other white leaders want the game to, you know, go on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line. And so, the geography of the Civil War is still in everybody's minds, right? And so for him, in order for baseball to be a national game, it has to be played in the former states of the Confederacy, or the states of the former Confederacy. So he reaches out and tries to get, say, for example, the teams in Virginia to join the National Association of Baseball Players. Well, kind of in backroom conversations, some overt, some covert, the Southern baseball leaders say there's no way we're joining an organization that doesn't meet our kind of cultural standards, you know. And so out of those kinds of conversations, there's a reconciliation movement, basically. If you know the historiography of, as you do, I know, Curtis, of Reconstruction, the idea that we're going to sell off some of the high priorities that were fought for, i.e. creating a more equal nation in order to kind of make things fit back together again. That's what the baseball world does too. And so they give away any idea of real equality among all ball players in order to have teams in the South join up in the National Association. And, you know, to add kind of salt to the wound that is, and then the South doesn't really come on board anyway. Even though Black ball players are kept out and Black clubs are kept out, the South still kind of, you know, tries to stay out of it, saying this is too Northern a game. So, but it's out of that desire to create a national, geographically speaking, national game that Black ball players are really pushed out.
Okay. Yeah. And you're, thank you for using the word reconciliation, because I'll admit in the process of working on my own dissertation in the last few years, I've kind of lost some of my easy words related to Civil War Reconstruction.
There you go.
But yeah, reconciliation, that is a very important concept for those listening. And if you want a good book, it's not the shortest book in the world, but it is a very easy read. So, but it's a book by David Blight called Race and Reunion, which does a really good job of giving an overview of how white Americans in the North and South decided to reconcile, to bring the country back together. But the process of that reconciliation meant, as Ryan's been talking about, in terms of baseball, but it happened across society, was excluding Black people from participating in a lot of public and national venues. So, baseball is a very important part of this, but it's not the only part of what took place in this era.
Yeah. But, well, and you just said it in about 10 seconds, what took me like 5 minutes to try to say. That was what I was trying to get to.
But that's the benefit of listening. I heard what all you said. I was like, okay, let me just condense it. I do want to get to, I guess, the because what we've been talking about so far is kind of this, not quite haphazard, but you can see a slow construction of this color line. Mm-hmm. But when does the color line become something that's very hard and fast, like something that just cannot be crossed no matter what?
So if you take those early precedents in the 1860s, basically the rules there are adopted whole, you know, kind of they're just kind of transferred from one page to the next when new baseball associations form. So the National Association of Professional Baseball Players forms in 1871 and takes the norms that had been established before it. And then when the National League is established in 1876, I would say that's when, you know, baseball, the color line is effectively drawn, because the National League being formed in 1876 takes all those norms and policies and puts them in place and adds money to the mix. And so professionalization further segregates baseball, because the game is, you know, you're trying to appeal to fans, you're trying to appeal to, again, kind of norms of respectability. And one part of that, one side part of that, is trying to encourage women to come to the ballpark, because it's seen. So if women come, the idea is, then men will be on better, you'll be better behaved. They won't gamble. Yeah. They won't do some of those things. And race and gender obviously are hugely intertwined. And so I would say by 1876, the line is firmly drawn. Now, there are some baseball scholars who will point out that there are interlopers who, you know, or they're trailblazers who mess with that line a little bit. But really, from 1876 until Jackie Robinson, you know, segregation is unfortunately extremely effective in terms of segregating the game.
Coincidence. 1876 was the year. Maybe it wasn't a coincidence, actually. 1876 was the year that happened, since that's typically thought of as the final year of, I guess, a robust reconstruction. You know, historians debate these things, but 1876 is largely considered the final year of reconstruction. From there on out, it's kind of like a slow death for the gains that have been made during that period.
Yeah, and I think the fact that the NL starts in 1876, it's about right for what baseball has become by that time in terms of fitting with the, not any sort of radical progressive version of Reconstruction.
Well, I would like to thank you, Ryan, for giving us a great very thoughtful overview. And this is an overview, like this is not all there is to know about the establishment of the color line. But thank you for giving us this overview and just, some really good thoughts to work with and consider. How baseball relates to wider American history, but also how segregation was something that was constructed. It didn't just happen. It was unfortunately, a very well thought out process and how it occurred.
It's been my pleasure. Yeah, as you say, this was a choice that was made by baseball, not a random happenstance. And so remembering that when we think about baseball today, I think is important. So it's been great to chat with you, Curtis.
And that's a wrap. Like to again express my appreciation for Ryan Swanson for giving us the details on how baseball constructed its segregated system. And do want to emphasize one more time the construction, the conscious choice to create a segregated sports system didn't happen by accident. Some people thought it was a good idea and they went about creating it, maintaining it. And now we'll see more about that maintenance in our discussion with Todd Peterson. And then finally, the takedown of the color line and is still the impact of that with Michael Lomax in our ensuing episodes. But thank y'all again for listening to the Negro Leagues, our Major Leagues podcast. See y'all back around here soon.